acquaintance simply because we have many ways of being together socially. For example, we seem to think having everyone vote works when it comes to running a country that can start wars, appropriate property, and execute malefactors. Yet we assume it's a bad way to run a business. There are lots of reasons for governance through voting, including assuring that people have a say in setting policies that affect them. But one is particularly relevant to business. Wisdom is a property of groups. In most instances, groups are collectively smarter than their individual members and often make more sensible decisions. The fact that typically the only group in a corporation that gets to vote is the board of directors is not an accident. Decision-making is usually more an exercise of power than an act of wisdom. Of course, majority vote isn't the only way to make decisions. There's consensus, compromises, negotiations of every stripe, even counting eeny-meeny. Yet for all this richness, in business we default to autocratic rulings. It seems a shame. So two outcomes are likely as the work of business increasingly moves online. First, we'll see more ways of deciding because we're seeing more ways of associating. Second, an important part of every project will be how you are going to decide. Yes, this requires focusing on something we've often taken for granted before, but it will also open up for explicit discussion the nature of the social interaction in any particular project. Is this a group effort, a team with leaders, a mob action, a ventriloquist act, or some other type of human association? Even raising this for conversation in a group changes the dynamics, for it acknowledges the fact that there are lots of ways humans can work together, and every type of association is a matter of choice. Unmanaging rich data. All this open information sounds like a nightmare to most of us, but in fact, information is the wrong term for it. We just don't have anything better. The term information, as we commonly use it today, is a product of the computer age. Before then, information meant something like news. The term took on special meaning first in information theory, where it received a mathematical definition to the yawning indifference of the awaiting public, and then in the computer world when data was invented. As everyone who's taken Computer Science 101 knows, information consists of significant correlations of data. Ants number 1 to number 100 died at 8:58 is data. Ants number 1 to 100 ate mayonnaise from the office cafeteria at 8:51 and died at 8:58 is information. Information is the stuff that goes into computers. And we all understand that to get the relevant facts about the world into our databases, we have to strip out a lot of the subtleties. For example, when we're populating our employee database, we have fields for name, start date, and salary, and maybe one for hobbies, but we certainly don't have fields for hates Thai food, can't remember names, hums while reading, and the things we know about our coworkers that together constitute a context for working with them. We strip out the context because that enables us to manage information. We select rows based on the content of the columns. We sort and arrange the rows. We look for interesting correlations of rows and columns. In short, information is stuff we generate precisely to be managed with computers. The web isn't about information, however. While it takes a database administrator or data entry specialist to enter data into a database, it takes any idiot with a computer to post something, from naked pictures of your cat to an overheated manifesto, on an intranet or on the web, and it's only going to get easier. So while we're populating our corporate databases with contextless, stripped-down information that can be managed, we're populating our new web world with every type of artifact the human hand can devise without a thought about how it will be managed. Information is built to be managed. The stuff on the web is the product of the lack of management. Information is stripped down. The content of the web is rich in its contextuality. These two sets of contrasts go together. Rich content and human voice. The stuff on the web tends to be rich, not dry disquisitions loaded with charts and tables. Rather than a nicely printed report entitled "An Analysis of Competitive Strengths and Weaknesses of Product Number 456A, you're more likely to get, "Why, gosh, honey, you smell great for a corpse, sucks, but will rule the underworld anyway." There are bunches of reasons why this is so. The web is a document world. Eons ago, there was the internet, and it was populated by a subculture of jolt-drinking, four-eyed, research-crazed academic geeks who used a Unix-like language to ferret out morsels of information, Unix is the Klingon of cyberspace, an argot only the true fanatics learn. Along came the web with two simple additions to the Internet. First, the web replaced screens and terminal emulations with a much more familiar and useful way of presenting stuff to be read, documents. Second, the web made it easy to hyperlink to a document without requiring the author's consent. This made it possible to navigate the web by clicking on content rather than by typing in path names. The web succeeded where the Internet failed, in other words, simply by adding a document front end and hyperlinking those documents together. The document user interface made it simple for people to get started with the web. Here's the instruction manual for a web browser. If it's blue and underlined, click on it. This is important because documents are our most richly evolved type of data. Our culture has spent a couple of thousand years figuring out how to express virtually any type of thought on pages. Because we are so close to documents in all their forms, it can be hard to realize just how good we are at reading them and just how much contextual information they convey. We parse the structures of a page instantly and thus can tell the footer from the footnotes, the header from the headlines, the byline from the lines of bile. Computers still can't match us at this. Just ask any user of optical character recognition software. The web is a document-based medium. It is built to handle the richness of documents. And interestingly, the very first improvements of HTML, the language in which web pages are written, mainly concerned themselves with simply enabling web pages to look more like spiffy printed pages. So we're used to documents. Documents are capable of handling a huge range of human expression and ways of structuring ideas, and the web lets us maintain this sophisticated way of communicating. The world of information on the web is, therefore, a whole lot richer than the domain of database information in both content and structure. But wait, there's more. The web is a voiced world. The web is the realm of the human voice. As we discussed in Chapter 2, your voice isn't simply the sounds that come out of your mouth. It's the way you present yourself in public through speech, writing, dress, body language, manners, virtually all that you do. The web liberates voice by making it so damn easy to communicate and publish. We have been trained throughout our business careers to suppress our individual voice and to sound like a professional, that is, to sound like everyone else. This professional voice is distinctive and weird. Taken out of context, it is as mannered as the ritualistic dialogue of the 17th century French court. We may be accustomed to the professional voice, but it isn't natural, God-given, or neutral. It's the voice of middle-aged white men who will do anything to keep people from seeing how frightened they are. The power table. Suppose you removed the table from your conference room and replaced the seats with armchairs. Suppose you turned it into a living room. How much would this affect your meetings? That's how much your meetings are about power, not communication. If you need to hear how the professional voice sounds, dig out any memo you wrote 4 years ago and compare it to how you'd write an email about it now. A professional memo obeys implicit rules such as one page is best, no jokes, admit no weakness, spell check it carefully, and send it to as few people as possible. Now we write emails. They're short, pithy, funny. They sound like us, and we CC the CEO on a whim. That's why most of us don't want to use a word processor to write our emails. We want to be free of the expectation that we've spell-checked it or even reread it before firing it off. We certainly don't want to waste our time monkeying with fonts and margins. At most, we'd like to be able to make words bold by hitting the keys harder. Email expectations. When you receive an email, you expect it to be brief, funny, hastily written, ill-considered, thoughtless, regrettable, all part of the charm. Christopher Locke. Email enables us to construct our voices at our leisure, resulting in some odd artifices. A voice is, after all, a complex thing. We have different voices for different environments and even for different people. We don't talk to our coworkers precisely the same way we speak to our children, well, unless we are very senior managers. Because most of our communications over the web are asynchronous, i.e., not real-time back and forth, we can construct our presence a bit more carefully. Our culture is currently in a phase where people are trying on voices, discovering what works and what doesn't work over email, bumping up against the limits, and making lots of mistakes. For example, while email can replace many meetings, primarily because at a physical meeting you can't skim over the remarks of dunderheads, email is a profoundly bad medium for conveying personal criticism precisely because it is textual and thus not very contextual. Here's another way the voice of email is destroying committee meetings. After the carefully controlled meeting is over and the bigwigs are congratulating themselves on how well they managed it, "I think we got exactly what we needed out of that meeting, JB." The junior people are back in their cubes, firing off emails parodying the results and pillorying the personalities. Meeting go boom. The return of voice is dooming not only the memo and the pointless drone-a-thon meeting, it's also turning the corporate propaganda newsletter into a flat-out embarrassment. Instead, individuals' zines are popping up in organizations, written by people with points of view, human voices, and usually a sense of humor. For example, at Optica, a small software company in Colorado Springs, Sean Spradling, a 26-year-old member of the marketing department, just up and began publishing Forecast This, an internal zine that presents Sean's highly biased view of the market and Optica's marketing efforts. If uplifting characterizes most corporate newsletters, skewering characterizes Forecast This. But its readers, the sales force, marketing, and most of Optica, know to trust it and look forward to getting it because it's written in a real voice stating the real truth. What a concept. In a hyperlinked organization, voice plays the old role of the org chart, telling you whom you should work with. That Mary is the under-VP of expectation deflations for the Western semi-region tells you nothing. That Mary is wicked smart, totally frank, and a trip to work with tells you everything. Thus do the formal bonds dissolve, replaced by the sound of the human spirit. Telling stories. The world is more like a huge set of messy hyperlinks than like a really big table of data. It is a world in which information isn't abstracted into some seemingly neutral means of expression, but is always uttered by some particular human in that person's own voice. So what happens to information management? On the one hand, it continues much as it is. We still need databases that reduce people to numbers. Couldn't live without them. But we also should recognize that the increase in available information has made us feel stupider than ever. All the printouts, all the database dumps, all the nicely formatted reports and spreadsheets with embedded charts are not describing our world to us. It's just not adding up. We have statistics but no understanding, and adding more and more information is only increasing the noise level. We don't need more information. We don't need better information. We don't need automatically filtered and summarized information. We need understanding. We desperately want to understand what's going on in our business, in our markets, and understanding is not more or higher information. The knowledge management impulse. Knowledge management has become a hot topic precisely because we silently recognize that our information isn't yielding understanding. But information is unsatisfying precisely because it's managed. To make it manageable, we strip out context and voice. So if we identify something called knowledge and then insist on managing it, we'll repeat the problem that gave rise to our desire for knowledge. Conclusion? If you want to get past information, you have to give up the hope of managing your and others' understanding of the world. Also, you can't do it yourself. All understanding is social by definition. If you want understanding, you have to re-enter the human world of stories. If you don't have a story, you don't have understanding. From the first accidental wiener roast on a prehistoric savanna, we've understood things by telling stories. I don't mean fiction or stories heavy with plot. I mean narratives that string events together in time and show them unfolding. For example, my young son, in some sense, understands World War II. His story is this. The Nazis attacked other countries and were winning until the USA stepped in and beat the Nazis. A Russian child's story about World War II is likely to be very different. The Allies delayed opening a second front until the incredible sacrifices Russia made wore the Nazis down, and then the United States finally came in and finished the job. Both stories are ways of understanding the war. My son doesn't understand the First World War because he doesn't have a similar sort of story, right or wrong. Once upon a time, there was an Archduke. Here's another example. I worked at a company that tanked for lots of good reasons. When a bunch of us ex-employees get together, some of us say that it was because the product got too inbred and complex. Others say that marketing failed to predict the platforms the software would have to run on. Others say that the management team was too focused on new products and ignored the bread and butter. None of us tell the same story, and that means that we, as a group, don't understand what happened. That's a sign of trouble, as we point out in the previous chapter. The company's origins are part of its authentic identity. That identity gets expressed in stories that sound something like these. Our founders were living in a garage and came up with an idea for mistake management. They thought it'd be great for law offices, but it turned out that lawyers are late adopters of technology. Then at one of the law firms they called on, they noticed that the secretaries were mixing whiteout with cream soda because... We're 157 years old and started out making faux papyrus, which was in great demand during the great Egyptian interior decorating craze in the mid-1850s. When that died out, we realized that we had manufacturing equipment that, if you just adjusted the thickness, could just as easily turn out prefab walls, and that headed us in the direction we're still in. This company was founded by tech weenies and got off a great product real early in the 3D fax market. That was a time when being first mattered more than anything, and the company lived on peanut butter and cheap drugs. But you know how it is. You hit a wall where you have to bring in the suits. So we went out and hired the former COO of Sears. When you get past the mission statement and the slide showing why your current market share and revenues are making Croesus envious, and you start to tell your story, only then do people begin to understand your company. And it's not just companies that have stories. Every sale worth knowing about has one. It looked like the bad guys were going to win this one, so I wrote this email, see, and sent it to this guy I know. Every repair job has one. I tried everything in the book to get the X405 to work, including repacking the bearings, which is a total pain, and then while I was tightening the booster ring, I noticed the damnedest thing. Every product has one. We couldn't figure out why no one was using the cup holders in the deluxe model, so we did a study and we discovered that the engine is so powerful that people were afraid to let go of the wheel. So we decreased it from 36 to 12 cylinders and scored a hit with the scaredy-cat driver market. We live in stories. We breathe stories. Most of our best conversations are about stories. Stories are a big step sideways and up from information. Unlike information, they have a start and a finish. The order counts a lot. They talk about events, not conditions. They imply a deep relationship among the events, a relationship characterized overall as unfolding, as if the end were present in the beginning, as of course it almost always is, as was foretold in a fractally recursive sense by Aristotle at our culture's beginning. Stories are about particular humans, no substitutions allowed. Unlike a set of economic forecasts or trends analysis, they do not pretend to offer the certainty that life will continue to work this way. On the other hand, the story is more likely to be correct than the forecast because it takes all of our current understanding of the world to accept a story. Stories are told in a human voice. It matters who's telling it. So, stories are not a lot like information, but they are the way we understand. How to apply this to your workaday world? You already have. When you are telling someone how you won this account or lost that one, when you were explaining why the competitor's trade show booth was a disaster, or when you were telling a financial analyst how the market got to be as wacky as it is, you're already telling stories. You can't help it. You're human. Stories are how we make sense of things. Anything else is just information. 7 ways to tell stories. 1. Ban the opening joke. Begin your next PowerPoint presentation by saying, "Let me tell you a story." And then recount what made the market the way it is, what got your company to come up with such an incredible product, and what obstacles particular customers faced and overcame by using your product. 2. Make sure the forms you use to collect knowledge have big empty boxes in them so the story can be told. 3. Every meeting with a potential partner, every exciting sales meeting, every important encounter with customers can best be told as a story. Do so. 4. Turn your next white paper into a narrative. 5. Collect the stories of your business and publish them on an intranet site. 6. Reward the tellers of good stories. They're the people everyone's listening to anyway. 7. Rewrite your mission statement as a corporate story. In fact, wouldn't a narrative version of an annual report help the company more than the usual hearty prose and canned snaps of happy employees? Brokenness. Stories are a way to understand a world that can surprise us. But in Fort Business, surprises are a sign of the failure of management. Management aims at predictability, and it tries to get there via control. The urge to manage is deep in our culture. It ultimately is defeated by the fact of human fallibility. It's in the web's nature to always be a little bit broken because it's decentralized. No one is in charge of making sure that the page you're trying to get to hasn't been taken down. There's no one to fix the web, no one to plan it, and no one to complain to. In fact, all big systems are broken. We don't always see that because what counts as broken is a matter of perspective. For example, on the phone system, sometimes we get busy signals, and sometimes the phone rings and rings and no one answers, but we choose not to count those as signs of brokenness. If the telephone system chose to treat busy and unanswered phones as broken, it could make answering machines a standard telephone service. We could even complain that we have to memorize long strings of numbers instead of having cute phone numbers like david.weinberger.the.balding.1@brookline.ma.usa. We choose to see the phone system as basically not broken and choose to see the web as inevitably broken. Why? Because fallibility is an endearing trait that seems to be a requirement for community. We, of course, want the people we work with to do everything they can to meet their commitments to us, but we also may find it hard to trust people who refuse to admit fallibility, their own and others. We are intensely uncomfortable with people who have no weaknesses, for example, Michael Jordan, Jesus, and my older cousin Don. The web's frailty makes it more human, less threatening. It also lets us move faster. For example, Mark Grancy, VP of Information Systems at Eddie Bauer, said in an article in Information Week, quote, "In the old cycle, you could hit analysis paralysis. Now you can't be afraid to make a decision just because the conditions are going to change and make that decision obsolete," unquote. He adds that perfectionism isn't allowed. You just have to do the best you can. Meanwhile, at Owens Corning, Mike Radcliffe, CIO, said, also in Information Week, quote, "Our staff has to be able to work with incredible ambiguity, be self-confident, simplify, and trust others. Most of all, we have to embrace good enough re-engineering, good enough that we can progress, not necessarily what we do in the ideal world," unquote. But it's not just systems that are imperfect. More important, so are we humans. Say it with me. Humans are imperfect. I am imperfect. Feels good, doesn't it? Clutrain's own politics of rightness. Clutrain itself is prey to one particular being right stratagem. Everything you know is wrong, in the words of Firesign Theater. Thus, our first temptation is always to find the way in which current beliefs are mistaken, preferably in some very clever and deep way. Knowing this, however, has not helped us get past it. Many more years of therapy are called for. We often use the phrase, knowledge is power, to make it seem that hierarchically granted power is justifiable. In most hierarchies, however, knowledge isn't power, it's a weapon. Being right advances you, and being wrong is a defeat. That sucks. You can see the politics of being right throughout most organizations. People win arguments, and thus secure their position in the hierarchy, through the cutting remark, through megatonnage of evidence, through agreeing with industry consultants, and through the smug refusal to ever admit being wrong. But wrongness has a lot going for it beyond the fact that some things can only be learned through trial and error. For example, some people are great at generating ideas but terrible at thinking through their impact. You want them to have as many bad ideas as possible because they will thereby randomly generate more good ideas. I tell my clients that I try to maintain a 9-to-1 ratio of bad ideas to good. And no, I can't tell which are which, if only. Errors are how assumptions become visible. And there is nothing more valuable than a newly discovered assumption, because only then can you see what's holding you back and what could propel you forward. There's too much to know, so all important decisions are, to some extent, random. By being free to make errors, you can try more paths until you stumble on one that takes you somewhere interesting, albeit probably not where you at first thought, mistakenly, you should be heading. Errors remind us that we're fallible humans. A company that's too embarrassed to admit mistakes and that builds a culture where being wrong is humiliating literally is denying what it is to be human. And you will pay the price in this world, if not in the next. Mistakes give us something to talk about. Being wrong is a lot funnier than being right. The right type of laughter, laughter at what the mistake reveals about our situation, rather than laughter aimed at a person who dares to be human, is enormously liberating. In fact, laughter is the sound that knowledge makes when it's born. Does your company have zero tolerance for error? Can you change your mind without losing status? If so, consider engaging in the radical politics of wrongness. Go out and commit a whopper. Then embrace it publicly. It's a good feeling. It's liberating. It's how you find your voice. Blurry boundaries. Webs have blurry boundaries. Fort Business, on the other hand, makes an enormous investment in maintaining the integrity of the walls. Hyperlinked organizations never met a wall they liked. In the world of closed rooms and weekly meetings, you're a member or not. To join, you have to commit to sitting in a room at a particular time. In the open, hyperlinked world, it requires nothing but a few clicks to check out what a particular group is doing. You join their email discussion group or visit their group intranet site. Zero commitment. So membership isn't a yes or no decision. You can browse with all the lack of commitment the word implies. When the hurdles to membership lower, the boundaries blur. The blurring isn't occurring only inside of the fort. Businesses are building extranets to enable their strategic partners to access information. There are hundreds of examples of this in industries that range from retailing to drilling for oil to distributing T-shirts to the people who print slogans on them. In many cases, extranets are used to get the paper out of the system. This enables process automation and cost savings, which are good things. But some companies, and someday all companies, are going farther than that, giving their partners and customers access to their own intranet so they can see the sausage being made. Intranet technology is sophisticated enough to let you control exactly who has access to what, so it's no longer an all-or-nothing proposition. You can let customers see product design discussions, but keep them from seeing what its competitors are saying to you. You can let a supplier check the processing of a payment, but keep it out of the pages where your accountants are evaluating bids. You have all the flexibility you need. The old excuses for pulling up the drawbridge and keeping everyone out entirely just don't hold. Why not let your customers see your product design process? They know that it's not perfect. They know you're going to go down wrong paths. You're going to abandon pieces you thought were locked in. You're going to squabble senselessly over trivia. That's what business is like. Every business is dysfunctional because everything human is at least a little bit broken. It's not an accident. It's the human condition. So what are you protecting your customers from? The obvious truth they know and live with every day? Just exactly whom do we think we're fooling? Companies that let their customers and suppliers into the process early on deliver better products, and they forge the bonds of trust and delight that are the only ones that work in the frictionless web. But maybe you need more than the promise of riches. Perhaps you need the fear of failure to motivate you. So here it comes. Suppose you use your extranet solely as a secure publishing site or for automating transactions that otherwise require paper, rubber stamps, and file folders. This will decrease your expenses and your time to market. Excellent. But if that's all you do, the first companies that knock down the walls to their customers and suppliers will eat your lunch and then beat up your children for their lunch money. Imagine the FUBAR company, the leading supplier of pen chains to the banking industry. Its development process calls on it to come up with a marketing requirements document that results in a product spec that in turn results in a new product. The entire development process is done behind walls because FUBAR can't let its competitor, Wumba Chains, find out what it's doing. But now FUBAR has discovered that Wumba is letting its customers into Wumba's product development processes way early in the game. As a result, Wumba's customers are ready with purchase orders the day the product ships, whereas FUBAR's customers need months of explanations and wooing from the sales force. And while Wumba's customers feel like they're getting the real poop, FUBAR's customers find the carefully constructed and controlled press releases and product brochures to be barriers more than helpers. They have to sort through them to try to get a sense of what's real and what's wishful thinking. So FUBAR decides to open the floodgates. Customers and suppliers are poking all around the innards of FUBAR Company. These outside companies are seeing the actual workings of the company, and that means they are getting to know the individuals in the organization. They're learning that for questions about the safety features of pen chains, they should listen to what Paolo has to say. For information about retrofitting cars for advanced pen chains, there's no better source in the industry than Mary. And when it comes to addressing future ideas for pen chains, you should never, ever pay attention to what Amit says. As this sort of knowledge gets absorbed, the outsiders start dealing directly with the individuals and hyperlinked groups in the organization. If a partner needs to know how the pen chains are going to work with the new government regulations, why go through legal or regulatory compliance or marketing, which will take 6 months to formulate some ass-covering BS, when you can pop into a worksite or have an email discussion among the people who really know what's going on and will tell you the truth? And when you pop into this group, are you going to know or care that some of the members are in fact other partners of FUBAR? If Juan is an articulate, knowledgeable, trustworthy voice in the discussion, will you know or care that he is in fact a supplier or an industry expert who works for one of FUBAR's customers? To the outside, the company begins to look like a set of hyperlinked clusters who select themselves based on trust and respect and even their sense of fun. The trust is built through the quality of voice of the participants. That is all that counts in a hyperlinked team. The business now consists of a shifting set of hyperlinked groups, self-organizing, inviting in participants based on the quality of their voice, regardless of where and whether they are on the org chart. Management is simply an impediment to these groups. In fact, rather than employees feeling that they must constantly justify themselves to management, management now needs to give workers a single reason why it should be involved in the life of the business it used to believe it ran. Hyperlinks subvert hierarchy. Hyperlinks subvert fort business. Business is a conversation. The economy of voice. No one's asking you to decide if you want to run your business using the web. It's a done deal. The internet has already set expectations for how connections ought to work. The gulf is there, a gulf caused, ironically, by the abundance of connection. The web is the sum of these connections. It isn't a medium, a new type of intercom, or an invention like really cool wristwatch walkie-talkies. It is a broad, open place that lets everyone touch everyone else and touch every digit of information by twitching a wrist and tapping a single finger. What connects you to me to everyone else are web pages and email and chat and discussions. These are all artifacts of human voice. Each is deliberately created and put forward as our public self, the self that is closest to us and, paradoxically, least knowable to us. An economy of voice. Has there been such a thing since the Athenians talked democracy into existence? The voices are heard in conversations. That's why the web has its transforming power. It turns out the fundamental elements of our world have been products of deep conversations all along, conversations carried on by philosophers, artists, poets, and other crafters of language. Had those conversations across the generations been different, we would not have the world we do. These particular conversations have given rise to a deterministic, causal world in which outputs result from inputs according to natural principles and self-evident rules. The world's mechanism depends not only on predictable, and thus interchangeable, parts, but also on the centrality and predictability of laws of nature, principles of behavior, and time itself, a recent achievement in our history. Socrates never said, "Hey, Alcibiades, what do you say we meet at the corner of Hesiod and Pericles at 3:15? Later, babe." Physical laws, rules of behavior, contracts, schedules, deadlines, professionalism, org charts, and management practices are all types of connections. They are all attempts to control not only the object of the connection, but also the nature of the connection itself. Why? Because they promise control over the two things we fear most: the vicissitudes of our world, and the passion of ourselves. As a manager armed with a theory and the latest business book, I not only know what to do, I know who to be. Then the web crept into our offices under false pretenses. We thought at first it was a library of information, then we thought it was a publishing medium, then we thought it was a toy or a dangerous distraction. But in fact it is a conversation of a new type, free of the need to get permission from Dad and his army buddies. New types of connections, the heart flowing to other hearts, a new rhythm, a new causality, a new understanding of power, conversation that understands that it isn't a distraction from work, it's the real work of business. The web is hitting business with the force of a whirlwind because it is a whirlwind. The closely held, tightly packed, beautifully tooled pieces are being pulled apart. they are rebinding themselves in patterns determined by the conversations that are occurring in every conceivable tone of voice. The character of business is becoming the same as the character of the web, an explosion reconfigured by the intersection of hearts. Chapter 6 Easy Answers by Christopher Locke and David Weinberger. Tell 'em what you told 'em. From the furthest historical reaches of Jump Street, markets have been conversations. Craft and voice were joined at the hip. What you made was how you spoke. But then it turned out that the world was round. There were other places across that big blue wet thing, and trade routes got longer, natch. Producers became further removed from markets. Gradually, marketing became an abstract pipe down which producers shipped products to customers, though nobody would invent FedEx for several centuries. Somewhere along the line, speech and craft lost each other's phone numbers. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, new power sources replaced much human grunt work. Producers immediately saw that this was a good thing. Moreover, they saw that repeatable processes and interchangeable parts were an even better thing, as such mechanization led to significant economies of scale, a fancy way of saying more money. By the time the 20th century rolled around, industry hit upon an even more potent multiplier, interchangeable workers. The assembly line turned workers into machines. Through this stroke of genius, craft skill was effectively hosed, and workers were told to shut up and do what they were told. Economies of scale also required economies of management. Telling them what to do efficiently required a new form of business organization. Bureaucracy fine-tuned the division of labor needed to make this new setup work, and a breakthrough concept called the org chart determined who got to speak at all. Welcome to management by command and control. This resulted in huge economies of scale, a fancy way of saying robber barons. Mass production led to mass marketing, which led to, ta-da, mass media. Broadcast applied the fundamental mass production brainstorm to marketing communications. This development signaled the dawn of junk mail. Corporate speech became mass-produced messages jammed into a one-way spam cannon aimed at a dream that hasn't faded since, interchangeable consumers. Ignoring the clear lessons of history, for example the nuking of Hiroshima and the saturation bombing of Dresden, upstart foreign companies started selling into markets the United States figured it had permanent dibs on. Guess again. The global economy threw a monkey wrench into the sweet deal that was mass production. Established markets broke up into a zillion micro-markets, leading to an explosion of new products and services. Now you could get a car specifically designed for your urban, sports, just-divorced, hockey fan lifestyle, or whatever. New knowledge was desperately needed to fuel this expansion, and this is when companies discovered what workers had long suspected but never talked about except in the washroom. Management didn't know its ass from a hole in the ground. See Clear Lessons of History above. While managers had gotten really good at bossing people around, they didn't know much about how things actually got made. This naturally resulted in many exciting high-level executive-type conferences about the knowledge deficit. Slowly, some are still attending summer school, companies began to realize that workers knew more than they'd been letting on, mostly because no one had asked them for about 100 years. This led to the reemergence of craft in the workplace and a concomitant revaluing of speech, a fancy way of saying, lead, follow, or get out of the way. Ideas, talk, and conversation were now encouraged among workers because they helped to deliver what organizations so desperately needed, a clue. During this period, which unfortunately ended in large measure due to downsizing, but that's another story, empowerment became the watchword of the day, and org charts were upended or tossed out altogether at companies like GE, Ford, Motorola, Corning, Cadillac, and Federal Express, which by now, of course, had been invented. This was the era of the U.S. Department of Commerce's Baldrige Award, when the pursuit of quality, always capitalized, took on a decidedly religious fervor. What quality really meant was, we changed our minds, please don't check your brain at the door. While speech was actively elicited from workers because it carried suddenly invaluable knowledge, it was not yet sought in any significant way from customers, a concept still perceived by many corporations as more dangerous than godless communism and universal health care combined. However, due to market fractionation, consumers had already become far less interchangeable. Then along came the internet, and all hell broke loose. Just as the global economy had precipitated exponential growth in the array of choice among new products and services, so the net caused an explosive proliferation of choice among new information sources. The broadcast model faltered and failed online. Embarrassing attempts to force it to work, such as push, were quickly swept under the rug, where, in the form of a large pig-in-the-python lump, they continued to trip up wannabe online businesses. By its nature, internet technology encourages open, distributed speech, a fancy way of saying telling it like it is. The human voice is the primary attractor, both to the medium and within it. Markets and workers are once again crafting their own conversations, and these conversations are also about craft, things we do that we actually care about. As a result of the profound and unexpected changes wrought by the net, the 200-year-long industrial interruption of the human conversation is finally coming to an end, both inside companies and in the marketplace. That's what Clutrain.com basically had to say when it hit the web in 1999. And you should see the flame mail we got. This is because we're now living in a period that could be called the hangover. Command and control is widely perceived as dysfunctional, but it's a hard-to-break habit. Many business leaders are well aware that bureaucratic hierarchy works against needed knowledge and communication, yet inertia is a powerful force. The cluelessness is strong in this one, Darth. Though the internet represents an unprecedented invitation to break out of this impasse, many organizations today resemble the Berlin Wall, monoliths interposing themselves between the internal conversation of the workforce and the external conversation of the marketplace. They are still pumping out mass-produced messages, still trying to control workers and consumers, still trying to create mass markets based on old industrial models. Via intranets, workers are already speaking among themselves. Via the internet, markets are already speaking among themselves. The convergence of these two conversations is not only necessary, but inevitable. Why? Because markets, unencumbered by corporate bureaucracy and the need to ask permission at every turn, are learning faster than organizations. Markets are therefore coming into a new ascendancy, a fancy way of saying, "We rule, dude." And increasingly, we value only two qualities. One, the engagement and passion for quality of genuine craft. Two, conversations among recognizably human voices. The simple if painful prognosis? Organizations must encourage and engage in genuine conversation with workers and markets or go belly up. So what, if anything, can businesses do at this juncture? They can begin by searching out people within the organization who understand what's going on. In almost every case, they're there. Make friends with them. Make friends with the marketplace again. Start listening. Find your voice. Then start talking as if your life depended on it. It does. Business is being transformed, but not by technology. The web is simply liberating an atavistic human desire, the longing for connection through talk. That's the one constant throughout our evolution, from caves to mud huts to open-air bazaars, from city-states to empires, nations, interdependent global powers. We've always conversed, connecting to the people of our world in our authentic voices. We connect to ourselves the same way. That's the mystery of voice. But part of us still has a deep resistance to the unmanageability of the web. We keep wanting to contain it within a business model, to build it into our business plans and see it as yet another opportunity for more, cheaper, faster, better business as usual. E-commerce, oh boy, ka-ching! The sound of the cash register is all too often the sound of attempts to co-opt the web, to tame it, domesticate it, make it more familiar, to shoot it, stuff it, and mount it in the corporate boardroom along with the other trophies of corporate conquest. At the same time that it spooks us, we're fascinated. We've been waiting for the web to happen all along. We've been hating our jobs for generations. We've been longing to speak in our own voices since we made the Faustian deal to keep quiet in the first place. The web is not aimed at business in particular. It wasn't built for business, it isn't fundamentally about business, and it can't be controlled by business any more than the internet could be controlled by the Pentagon that sponsored it. The web is inherently and intrinsically free. Businesses will perceive this fact as either a blessing or a curse depending on how much they value freedom, a quality of mind and heart not typically underscored in the average corporate mission statement. Loaded Questions. Literature is the question minus the answer. Roland Barthes. If love is the answer, could you please rephrase the question? Lily Tomlin. Overheard at the cocktail party that was the 1990s. So, what's going to happen with all this web stuff? Where's it going? What are the trends? What are the directions? Who's going to win? And they say there's no such thing as a dumb question. Continents drifting across the oceans have trends. Bullets have directions. Cannonballs have trajectories. The future doesn't. The future is the intersection of choice and interruptions. The web, what a surprise, is more like the future than a cannonball. It will be what we make of it. This leads to a funny conclusion. Ironic, actually. We ask questions about the future of the web because we think there's a present direction that can be traced into the future. But in fact, the questions we ask aren't going to predict the future, they will create the future. Not to get all heavy and ontological, but since questions are a type of conversation, it looks a bit like conversations give the world its shape, doesn't it? Questions do the spade work. They prepare the ground for answers. Be careful what you ask, or you just might become it. So far, the questions about the web we hear the most, the ones some journalists use to stir up fear, the ones some politicians use to prepare us for the revelation that they just happen to be our saviors, the ones most businesses use to keep us in line and to sell us more stuff, these questions are actually decisions to look for the same old things. Their assumptions are wrong, and the answers they call for are mean-spirited. The questions themselves are intended to confuse the issue, and the answers are nothing but the smirk on the face of someone who just proved himself right. There are other questions possible, better questions. Questions that come from the heart, not the wallet, the gonads, or the lobe of the brain responsible for smugness. Questions that open the future instead of making sure the deadbolt on the door is nice and tight. For example, take the ever-popular question, will the web become a broadcast medium? Will it become TV? That's vitally interesting to media titans who see the web as a threat to how they make money, but that's not a question of the heart. What the heart wants to know is, when the buttons at our fingers let us talk with the polyglot world's artists, how will we cope? What will we share as a culture and community? What will we talk about together? What will we laugh about? What type of laughter, mocking, ironic, cynical, sinister, belly-shaking guffaws, are we going to hear? Will we find we all share a common sense of humor, or will we learn to laugh in new languages? When will we record the first case of web inebriation, a transglobal xenophilia induced by pure, uncut connectedness? Here's a question beloved of industry analysts and others who think the point of conversation is to appear smart. How quickly will commerce move to the web? Let's trot out the charts and studies, confident that at least one of them is going to turn out to be right. But is this question really so important, or does it just address a detail about timing? Is your business going to be transformed if it turns out we're not going to hit the gazillion mark until 2004 instead of 2003? But there is a heartfelt question lurking here. It has to do with the things of the world that quench our thirsts and raise our souls. It has to do with our fear of replacing the shops and the neighborhoods they enable with a paper-soled efficiency that lets us search out and consume commodity products at disquietingly low prices. We're afraid that the last shred of human skin left on the bones of commerce is about to come off in our hands. We want to know how we'll reconnect to the other people in the market, buyers and sellers, people we know or whose faces are the landscape of our life in the agora. And we have this fear precisely because the e-commerce question has been asked wrongly so often, as if once commerce becomes virtual, it will become cruelly automatic. We need to ask the heartfelt question about how we're going to talk about the things we care about, or e-commerce will indeed become nothing but the soundless scrape of coins over the wire. Here's another question, top of the hit parade, actually, that steers us in a wrong direction as surely as asking, how can I drive straight to hell, buddy? The question is, what are we going to do about pornography on the web? This question seems to have nothing to do with business, but in fact it goes straight to the heart of maintaining a corporate wall between employees and customers, between internal and external behavior. The question has to do with drawing the line between the public and the private. No trivial matter, since looking at the line is the quick and dirty way we decide who's civilized and who's savage, who's refined and who's a brute. The line between public and private is, of course, arbitrary, although we adamantly deny this by using every method of intimidation, from the law to dirty looks, to maintain it. The main point of the line is that there be a line, one that we can control. And then we turn on our computer and filth comes pouring out of every orifice from our email inbox to our browser. Go to whitehouse.com and you discover it's a porn site. Hint, next time, try whitehouse.gov. Open an email titled, "The Info You Asked About," and get lewd invitations. Mistype a single letter of a web address and you're staring at strange genitals in strange configurations. The web isn't just redrawing the line, it's changing the nature of the line, making it explicitly permeable. But a new type of line means a new type of public. So our hearts ask questions with dread as well as excited curiosity about the new public world and its relation to the private. What is the relation of our night selves and our day selves, our self behind the company walls and outside of them? Why do we think of our private selves as our real selves? What would privacy be like if it weren't connected to shame? What is the fierce price we pay for every desire, every whim, every idea we stamp secret? To what degree are shame and embarrassment the expression of the will to control? If we abandon the illusion of controlling private behavior, what type of publicness will we have? How is the control we yearn to exert over the behavior of others, at work and beyond, identical with the white-knuckle control we need to preserve ourselves? More questions meant to distract us. How will we know what's junk on the web and what's worth believing? How will we avoid being fooled by anyone with a plausible story and a web address? What will be the new criteria, the new marks of authenticity? These questions express a longing for someone to take charge of our knowledge. We want experts and authorities, just as we crave censors more than we crave sex and prefer certainty to freedom. But our hearts have a different set of questions. When we can't rely on a central authority, the government, the newspaper, the experts in the witness box, for our information, what new ways of believing will we find? How will we be smart in a world where it's easier to look something up than to know it? How will we learn to listen to ideas in context, to information inextricably tied to the voice that's uttering it? How can we reverse our habit of understanding matters by jumping to further levels of abstraction and instead learn to dig into the concrete, the personal, and the unique, told as stories worthy of our time? We are, all of us, asked questions like, how will we manage, control, virtual workers in a distributed organization when our hearts want to know how we are going to live with our families again? We are asked, how are we going to keep our children safe on the Internet, when our hearts also want to know what it would be like to be a child who can talk within the world's society of children? We're asked, how can you tell if the person you're talking with is really the person you're talking with, when our hearts want to know what people we will really become online and what having a disembodied identity will mean? We are asked, how are the poor of the world going to get Internet access, when our hearts want to know how we can connect with the poor of the world because there isn't a single person we don't want to talk with? And once we talk, we know the conversation will make palpable the injustice of today's economics. Our job now is not to answer questions. It is to listen past the questions based on fear and to hear the questions of the heart. Why? Because the proper answer to a heartfelt question is a conversation, and conversations make the world. Hit one out of the park. Good, then. That ought to put all the wrong-headed questions to rest, right? No, of course not. Business as usual being what it is, the questions never quit. Companies have said yes, the clue train ideas are interesting, but give us a place to start, a methodology, a suite of best practices maybe, a set of guidelines, for God's sake, something. What's the bottom line, they want to know? How can my company profit from the coming transcultural train wreck? How can we leap tall buildings in internet time, innovate faster than a speeding data packet, and establish peace, justice, and the American way in hyperlinked global markets? Well, okay. Because you've been so patient and read so bloody much, we'll let you in on the secret of our success. Just follow the 12 easy steps below, and you're sure to be on your way to fame and fortune in the exciting new world of web business. Caution, it is vital that you follow these steps precisely in the order given. Otherwise, we are not responsible for the mutant hellspawn you may inadvertently call forth from the realm of the undead. The Clue Train Hit One Out of the Park 12-Step Program for Internet Business Success. 1. Relax. 2. Have a sense of humor. 3. Find your voice and use it. 4. Tell the truth. 5. Don't panic. 6. Enjoy yourself. 7. Be brave. 8. Be curious. 9. Play more. 10. Dream always. 11. Listen up. 12. Rap on. Do these things and you just can't miss. Of course, there's as much distance between this advice and the decisions you make every day as there is between Go Forth and Multiply and 100 Ways to Pick Up Hot Chicks and Radical Dudes. Still, we yearn for easy advice. It's so hard to give up the old wish for stimulus response marketing and management. Hard to go back to the days of the talking cure when psychotherapy meant years of slogging through memories and dreams instead of a slap on the back and instructions to nurture the inner child and eat 2 bran muffins every day. Hard to forget the televised version of Anna Karenina that goes from start to finish in 2 hours. The train comes to a screeching halt just in time, and reopen the musty volume and soak into every snow-flecked page. Look, we'd love to derive 12 happy instructions from the wash of ideas swirling around us. Really, we could market those puppies like Tang in a sauna. Seminars, workbooks, t-shirts, coffee mugs. But it doesn't work that way. This is an existential moment. It's characterized by uncertainty, the dissolving of the normal ways of settling uncertainties, the evaporation of the memory of what certainty was once like. In times like this, we all have an impulse to find something stable and cling to it, but then we'd miss the moment entirely. There isn't a list of things you can do to work the whirlwind. The desire to have such a list betrays the moment. There may not be 12 or 5 or 20 things you can do, but there are 10,000. The trick is, you have to figure out what they are. They have to come from you. They have to be your words, your moves, your authentic voice. The web got built by people who chose to build it. The lesson is, don't wait for someone to show you how. Learn from your spontaneous mistakes, not from safe prescriptions and cautiously analyzed procedures. Don't try to keep people from going wrong by repeating the mantra of how to get it right. Getting it right isn't enough anymore. There's no invention in it. There's no voice. Maybe we'd have more luck with a clue train list of don'ts than with a list of do's. The first 94 items would be things like, don't snoop on your employees, don't build knowledge management systems and corporate portals that are nothing but funnels for the same old propaganda, don't hire people who claim to be experts at increasing morale, and right at the bottom of the list, number 95, would be the most important one. Don't rely on lists, self-styled gurus, or business books. Scary, isn't it? Good. You ought to be scared. That's a realistic reaction. You want comfort? Invent your own. Exhilaration and joy are also in order, but face the facts. The tracks end at the edge of the jungle. Chapter 7 Post-Apocalypso by Christopher Locke. We will strive to listen in new ways, to the voices of quiet anguish, to voices that speak without words, the voices of the heart, to the injured voices and the anxious voices, and the voices that have despaired of being heard. Richard M. Nixon, First Inaugural Address, 1969. Irony is perhaps the most common mode of Internet communications. The net didn't create the mentality, but it did come along just in time to give it new expression. Nixon speaking about unheard voices of the heart from the height of the 1960s is a prime example of why most people have despaired of ever being heard at all, and of why they've stopped listening for answers from above. From big government, big business, big education, big media, big religion. With few exceptions, the interlocking agendas of these monolithic powers have become utterly divorced from the constituencies they were originally conceived to serve, their interests as remote from our daily lives as the court of King George was to the American colonies in 1776, and you know what happened then. So are we calling for a revolution? What would be the point? The only revolution that matters is already well underway. And by the way, since it's not being covered by CNN and Fox, we're winning. You say you didn't notice anything out of the ordinary? Nor were you supposed to. Invisibility and ignorance are powerful weapons. Ignorance is not a value you often hear extolled. Let's make up for lost time. Here's how it works. It's pretty simple. When you ignore people long enough, they begin to feel invisible. Because your important concerns do not concern them, they begin to figure it's a two-way street. They begin to ignore you back. Pretty soon, they're thinking Al Gore is some hockey player from Winnipeg, and Warren Buffett, isn't he the guy who does late-night infomercials for cut-rate country western CDs? Three easy payments and it's yours? Yeah, but who really cares? Ignorance is power. A maxim often heard online is that the Internet roots around obstacles, meaning it ignores them. In its early phase, the net ignored business. Internet audiences simply weren't interested, and the feeling was mutual. Business ignored the net for a long time, not seeing it as what it thought a media market should look like, which is to say, television. This mutual ignorance served as the incubator for a global revolution that today threatens the foundations of business as usual. Before any old order of things can be given the final heave-ho, coup de grace, it's necessary to create a parallel infrastructure controlled by people acting in cooperation for their own benefit and mutual support. One thing any such effort requires is an extraordinarily efficient means of communication. We didn't used to have one. Telephones just didn't cut it. Then, irony of ironies, along comes the Internet. It was as if we'd ordered it from Amazon. Hello, U.S. federal government? Yes, we'd like one totally open, high-speed data backbone. Uh-huh. And charge that to the Department of Defense, why don't you? What's that? What do we want it for? Oh, just chatting about stuff, you know, this and that. Invisibility is freedom. At first it feels awful that no one can see you, that nobody's paying attention. Darn. But you get used to it. We've had 200 years to get used to it. Then one day you find yourself on a network, networking, and it dawns on you that it's like walking through walls. Wow! Like some comic book mystic ninja warrior. That's pretty cool. You can get away with saying things you could never say if anyone took you seriously. Dilbert is just a comic strip. Ha ha. Beavis and Butthead is just a cartoon. Heh heh. And if anyone comes sniffing around and wonders if this Internet stuff could be maybe dangerous, culturally subversive, it's, oh, hey, never mind us. We're just goofing off over here on the web. No threat. Carry on. As you were. But we aren't just goofing off. We're organizing, building and extending the net itself, crafting tools and communities, new ways of speaking, new ways of working, new ways of having fun. And all this is happening, has happened so far, without rules and laws, without managers and managed. It's self-organizing. People by the millions are discovering how to negotiate, cooperate, collaborate, to create, to explore, to enjoy themselves. But what's the point, asks business. Business always wants there to be a point, a goal, an objective, a plan. Otherwise, how would we manage? There never was any grand plan on the Internet, and there isn't one today. The net is just the net. But it has provided an extraordinarily efficient means of communication to people so long ignored, so long invisible, that they're only now figuring out what to do with it. Funny thing. Lawless, planless, management-free, they're figuring out what to do with the Internet much faster than government agencies, academic institutions, media conglomerates, and fortune-class corporations. So what is the net really good for? Besides chatting, that is. Well, there's the small matter of coordinating distribution. Remember those ancient markets from way back in the first chapter where we talked about trade routes and the cities that grew up where they intersected? Where caravans arrived with exotic merchandise and tried to sell their wares? Figs here! Delicious figs! Give me one. Figs want to be free. No way! I won't buy from you if I can't have a taste. From where I'm standing, your figs smell like your camel pissed on them. My camel is very well behaved. He never urinates. But enough about early advertising. One thing the net is good for is organizing markets, especially if you're invisible and powerless, ignorant of how things are supposed to work, ignorant of business as usual, especially if you're intent on end-running the empire. Who has the stuff we like? Who makes the stuff we need? Interest, curiosity, craft, and voice combine to create powerful self-organizing marketplaces on the web. Figs here, delicious figs! Or it might be a faster chip, an elegant bit of code, a new idea, a joke, a line of poetry, a job. Stuff, as the digital world has taught us, isn't always stuff. And coordinating how it gets distributed is more like a cocktail party than a strategy session. Stuff gets around the way word gets around, along the same routes, around the same obstacles. Though motivated by altogether different principles than those driving business, this is not as chaotic as it may sound, nor as inefficient. It's happening right now, every day. It works. Follow the money may still apply, but to find the money in the first place, follow the conversation.